arms were free.
Yes, I mean, the materials were so heavy and thick that there was no way you would be able to work in gloves constructed of it. And the net result, of course, was that you suffered a great deal from the cold, both on your hands and on your head, where you only had a thin one skin rubber hood, tight hood. And the maximum amount of time you could spend in the water would be 20 minutes. You would then have to go into the forward compartment of the duct that you were operating from, which was warmed, and then gradually recover and start again later when somebody else had had a go.
So you were just working a Schouwen island, were you?
Yes, that was the one. Our sections, in fact, were split up all round Holland. The island I was on was Schouwen, and I think there were probably another four or five of us on that particular group. Some were involved in taking landing craft and larger craft, which we had stationed with us in Germany, into the various islands and taking food supplies to them and so on. And at one stage we were using small inflatable craft with outboard engines on them to collect all the dead cattle together and tie them up in a long convoy and then gradually take them to a point of dry land where they could be burnt, so as to clear the area of this epidemic danger. It's very difficult when you're English and you see flooding in this country that you tend to think of it on the same scale, but when Holland floods you have a major problem. And Schouwen, for example, the dikes are some 30 to 40 feet above the high water mark, normal high water mark, but the ground inside, of course, is probably 10 foot lower than the surrounding sea. Maybe not quite as much as that. So that when the dike walls became breached, as they were on this long canal leading up to the small town of Zierikzee, they were breached in five places. When it was low water outside at sea, all the water in the fields, trapped in the fields behind these dikes, had to pour out again through the breaks in the dike walls. And getting to Zierikzee in itself was an adventure, because the water coming out of the fields back into the sea was probably about 10 foot high, just like a waterfall. And they were gushing out through the wall, virtually right the way across the canal that you had to go up. And so the only way we could get up there was for the landing craft to be towed behind a high-speed torpedo recovery craft, which we had with us, on a very short tow. And the torpedo recovery craft would get up maximum speed and hit into the waterfall very close up to the dike wall. As it hit it, it would then be slewed right across and bounce off the dike wall on the other side, canal wall, and into the next one. And this journey, of course, had to be done because it was the only way of getting supplies through to these people still trapped in Zurich. So it was a period which had its moment.
How many of you were working at Schouwen?
Schouwen, we would have about seven or eight divers. I think there was probably about the same number, about seven or eight landing craft. These were the small landing craft, what we call landing craft assault.
Did the Dutch seem to be appreciative?
Oh yes, very much so. I mean, the locals looked after us. When we left to go back to Germany, after two or three weeks, we stopped at Nijmegen on the way back. And of course, apart from the fact that they knew that we were coming, returning from the Dutch floods, all the chaps in the SBS are of course parachutists. And so once they saw our parachute wings on our arm, they had very vivid recollections of Arnhem and the airborne drops during the war. And, well, it was just like a conquering army entering a town, that we were just literally lifted off our feet and taken away to the bars and the restaurants and looked after. And they were extremely good to us.
And as far as the work on the Rhine to deny the Russians the craft were concerned, presumably that was just standing by in case something happened.
Yes. They were finally withdrawn from Germany in the mid-50s, really, when the immediate threat of the Cold War had sort of decreased a bit. But by that time, the amphibious warfare element of the Royal Marines had set itself up with the Commando Brigade in Malta. And another special boat section was formed, and that was stationed in Malta to act as the reconnaissance unit for the amphibious warfare squadron and for any landings undertaken by the commandos. And so that section, which was trickle draft supplied by Marines, so that the section itself stayed there and people were replacing people who'd been there for 2.5 years or so, that stayed there right up until the time when the whole of the Commando Brigade and the amphibious warfare squadron went out to the Far East, which was for some, it would be nearly 10 years, I suppose.
What was your work in the latter part of the 50s then? What were you involved in?
I was in 6 SBS in Malta for 2.5 years. Quite an exciting time because, of course, the EOCA campaign in Cyprus was still going on. The commandos were still having to go there on 3-month tours in aid of the civil power, as it's called. While we were in Malta, there was an uprising in Libya and a plot to assassinate King Idris, which, if I remember rightly, was the start of Colonel Gaddafi's taking over. And the whole of the Commando Brigade were immobilised and put in the amphibious warfare squadron and went off to North Africa to try and do some rapid sort saber rattling to try and re-establish the monarchy, because Guido always had quite friendly relations with King Idris.
Did you go then?
Yes, we again did our normal role, which was whenever the amphibious warfare squadron were going to do a landing, which they would have had to have done, we would carry out the beach reconnaissance for them first, establish what the gradients of the beaches were, and where the exits were and what the road structure of the beach was in terms of getting transport across it and so on. All this was done, obviously, perfectly openly. And we were able to produce reports on all the beaches which the squadron was expected to land on during that period. And then if they had to land, we would go in first and mark the beach for them.
Which year would this have been?
This would have, I actually served in 6 SBS from 58 to 1960.
But the expedition to...
Oh, for North Africa, that would have been early 59, I think.
Anything else that happened to you in Libya?
No, I don't think so. It's all very straightforward.
Did you take part in the anti-EOCA operation?
No, but our time in 6BS, or my time in 6BS, coincided with the withdrawal into the sovereign bases. And so we did quite a lot of reconnaissance work around Cyprus prior to the withdrawal into the sovereign bases. Really checking to make sure that we knew where the units, the Commando Brigade, could land if ever they were called in at short notice to sort some problem out. Because once we'd withdrawn into the sovereign bases, of course, we would no longer have access to the rest of the island. So we spent a fair amount of time there looking at various very attractive seaside resorts.
And then after your 2.5 years in Malta?
I then returned to the United Kingdom to the Special Boat Service training base, where they teach the basic requirements of what is now known as the swimmer canoeist qualification. And I then spent nearly 2 years there as an instructor teaching various subjects for the special boat wing, which canoeing, tactics, and diving at various times. A typical normal service instructional job. And then it was while I was doing that I was invited to join 2SBS in Singapore as their Sergeant Major, which I jumped at the chance. It was an accompanied tour. It looked as though it was going to be a very attractive part of the world to take a family to. And as I'd been asked to go as the Sergeant Major, of course, the commanding officer of the section was well known to me, and we were good friends. And so it was, had all the makings of a very nice two and a half year commission.
When did you go there?
1963, January 1963, I think it was, that I joined the section there, which was shortly after the Brunei Rebellion, which had been put down by a force of Gurkhas and a 4-2 commando. And at the time when the Federation of Malaysia was in the process of being formed. So it looked as though it was going to be a relatively stable 2.5 years. Unfortunately, Dr. Sukarno of Indonesia seemed to have different ideas, because very soon after the start of 1963, we started getting reports of Indonesian border terrorists crossing the border, raping women, killing headmen and so on in the various kampongs, and generally trying to spread up dissent and dissatisfaction with what had been British rule but were now fast becoming home rule by this Malaysian Federation. Right, the section that I was with was stationed in Singapore as its permanent base, in the naval base at HMS Terror. And initially we had a very nice time. The section were involved in jungle training at the Jungle Training Center in Ulu Tiram, and assisting in the training of Vietnamese soldiers and Marines in crossing rivers and use of small boats. And we'd been doing that sort of training come instructing tasks for 3 or 4 months when the first of the rather large incursions by the Indonesian border terrorists occurred. And the starting of our involvement occurred when 4-2 Commando sent a signal back to Singapore saying that they in an intelligence report saying that there were 120 or so IBT anticipated as coming in by sea around the end of the border near Tanjung Datu, which is the western end of Borneo. We were flown out at a few hours' notice with all our equipment, and after being lifted by helicopter, eventually arrived at a forward location of 42 Commando at a place called Samatan, which was a small kampong with a bauxite mine, which was presumed to be the target of any IBT band that wished to cross the border in that area. And it was situated about 30 miles back from the actual headland that the border ran down. As we were the only people in the area that were equipped with boats, we immediately set up boat patrols near the border headland. Two men in a small inflatable, and with a wireless set, keeping an eye open for what we believed would be probably a Cumpit or some such craft. A Cumpit being the local equivalent of a motor fishing vessel, probably of about 40 ton, capable of carrying anything up to 100 armed men. And we suspected that if there was an incursion, it would be by that means around the headland and in towards Samatan. The intention was to spot them before they could land and forewarn the troops ashore. However, one of our problems was that our inflatable craft, although they were very seaworthy, they very quickly suffered from the excessive pounding of having to motor 30 miles up to the border from Samatan and then 30 miles back again at the end of each night. And we very soon had a rather hefty repair problem on our hands. And so to ease the situation, we set up observation posts on the headlands nearest the border. Three men landing at night so that they couldn't be observed by the locals or any of the IBT who might have been in the area, taking up a position where they could study the offshore approaches and at the same time be reasonably protected from the rear by rocks or thick jungle. They would stay there for 3 days, reporting if they saw anything, and be picked up again at night by inflatable and brought back to Samatan. We kept up that sort of routine for over a month, and eventually, and I'm not sure where the idea came from, we were allowed to set up a residence on a place called Turtle Island, which was a typical tropical island with a beautiful villa at the end of a silver sand beach, unoccupied. We were allowed to use that for nearly 2 months as our base. It was called Turtle Island because obviously the sandy beach was used as a nesting point for all the turtles in the area. And the villa had been built by the curator of the Sarawak Museum, who'd been one of the original stay-behind parties in Malaya during the war against Japan. And so he had some experience of the sort of work that we might be involved in doing and was always very helpful to us. We were in a much better position working from Turtle Island. The distance to travel in the boats to our operating area was much shorter. And all the time that the southeast monsoon was in being, which it was during this first period we were there, we were relatively safe because it was extremely difficult to land anywhere. There was a very strong onshore swell all the time. And we could just use one man for guarding our own base camp on the island and devote all our energies to manning our observation posts and operating our offshore inflatable craft patrols. Eventually, however, when the southeast monsoon ended, it became necessary to move back to Samatan because we were then too exposed. There was a very real danger that if anyone did carry out a raid, they could possibly land on Turtle Island and we would be quickly overwhelmed. after we'd been carrying out this sort of work for 3 months and without any evidence of any incursions in the area, we received an intelligence report that there was an IBT training camp a short distance over the border, and we then carried out a reconnaissance to determine if it was in fact there, and used two canoes operating from another small craft to get to within a few hundred yards of the supposed location of the camp. The canoes landed, and the operators then went inland, spent a day ashore looking. They eventually found the camp, but it had been disused for some time, and so they were able to just have a look and make sure there was nothing of any intelligence value there, and then we returned. And that really ended our first involvement in confrontation in Borneo.
What does IBT stand for?
Indonesian Border Terrorist. They were obviously local people, supposedly led by Dutch renegade settlers, and they were extremely vicious, not particularly well armed. During this initial period of confrontation with Indonesia, they were really like marauding bands of old, carrying out attacks on small kampongs and generally trying to unsettle the natives. But of course, during the period of confrontation, the military forces on both sides built up initially because Indonesia, realizing that they couldn't get the British government to move out and to withdraw from the area, decided to start a bit of saber rattling themselves. And so they put amphibious forces and Indonesian marine battalions with their armored amphibious vehicles on islands very close to Borneo. And when I say very close, I mean within 1,000 yards of a main port in Borneo. And this, of course, required an appropriate build-up of British forces in the area. So by the time confrontation was at its height, there was probably something like 70 to 75,000 British servicemen involved in overcoming the problems of confrontation.
In what way were they so vicious?
The IBT. Simply that they would kill the natives and rape women and generally act like marauding bands of old. Certainly the natives were very, very frightened. And one of the first things that happened from a British point of view was that wherever possible near the border, the local tribes were brought into a larger kampong rather than being in small little groups set out on their own. And the larger kampongs were then armed by a section or a troop or a platoon of army or marines who would set up a stronghold within the location so as to offer a degree of protection, very much like a modern day version of the barons with their castles and the villages being brought in for protection. And certainly that, although it didn't defeat in any way the IBT, it stopped a lot of the incursions because there were less and less easy targets for them to have a go at. But of course, once the military build-up started, there was much more concern that Sukarno would use his military forces to make a proper military attack on some area or even on Singapore itself towards the end. And as I say, proportionally, the British forces had to build up to be able to counter the threat.
Did you ever come across any civilians on your side of the border who were sympathetic to the Indonesians?
No. Our actual contact with the local people was different from the army and marine units who were occupying these strongholds and working ashore permanently, because we were moving into an area for a specific task all the time, and in order to be able to do that and devote our efforts to the actual task we've been given, we had to have a defended location to operate from. And so we were either based with an army company in their location or with a Gurkha company, but always with somebody who could provide us with defense while we were resting and recovering and cleaning our weapons and equipment ready for the next job that we've been given to do. And so our actual contact with the locals was minimal, because obviously when the type of work we were doing, which was all intelligence gathering, designed obviously to make sure that in terms of scale of build-up of military forces in the area on the two sides, that we knew exactly, or as much as we could know, of what the Indonesians were doing. And so all the tasks that we were given were designed to go and find out a specific bit of information about whether they had an outpost located up a certain river, or whether they had a certain type of craft in use, and so on.
So it was that rather than actually having to fight them yourself?
Oh yes. We were never given an attacking role. It was always a intelligence gathering role.
And what makes you think they were being led by a Dutchman?
Well, this was simply the information we got from intelligence reports, the follow-up by the Borneo police and the army authorities would produce an intelligence report saying what the current state of play was. And the initial problem was these marauding bands. I think that there was sufficient information on the description of the Dutchmen for them to know what their names were and where they'd come from, and so on. Although I can't remember any details of them over this period of time. But the border, of course, in Borneo, having gone across an island before, of course, comes out onto another seaward end, roughly the length of England away from the end that we'd started off at. And so when there was the build-up of Indonesian forces at the other end of the border with Borneo, we were flown into that area to do a similar job, to try and ensure that there were no incursions into a place called Kawi Harbour, which has got a very large timber extraction sawmill and logging ground around it, quite a large harbour. And our task initially was to look, as we had done at the other end, to see if there were any incursions by these bands of terrorists. But while we were there,